No, Randy said. I looked up from the newspaper clipping, and the realtor was as serious as a stone. She died in the house. Only problem was she died long before anyone found her. How does that happen? I mean, I know the house is out in the country, but still. She was a widow. All her children had moved out of state. She'd burned bridges with any friends she had left many years before, Randy said. And she was a hoarder. A whore? She was 89, for God's sake! No, Rick, a hoarder. She didn't throw out a newspaper for years. When they finally cleaned out the house, they found food in a pantry, dated from sometime in the mid-90s. She never met a sale she didn't like, Randy said. Regina Fitzpatrick was a mentally ill woman. The plain fact was, nobody missed her. Her body was badly decomposed by the time she was found. I thought of the house my wife and I had moved into. The house we'd come to call our home, and where we had discovered our family would be expanding soon. Of the bed we shared, our cat, the lawnmower, and the animal skeleton outside. I leaned over Randy's desk. Okay. So how was the house in such terrible shape with her, and it looks almost brand new now? That's because it isn't the same house. Not really. The home was in terrible shape. Mold and trash everywhere. Her son came up from Mississippi and spent nearly $30,000 of his mother's life insurance money to rehab the house to sell it. All the carpet was replaced, along with underflooring in many of the rooms. The walls were treated for mold and repainted. He bought all new appliances, and after a few months, it was essentially a brand new home. You and Jennifer are the first couple to live there since Mrs. Fitzpatrick died, Randy said, by way of explanation.
When I wake, it takes me a minute to realize where I am. So many things feel familiar, but are not quite the same. The smell of smoldering ash wafts about the room, and I notice that last night's votives have just expired. As the smoke tendrils snake up into the ceiling, everything comes back to me. Visions of last night flash forth in my head, like a movie that is being viewed in extreme fast forward, but on occasion switches to slow motion. I see Kevin and I sitting in bed and talking, followed by his wild gesticulations as he convinces me to sleep with him. I want to turn it off, but the harder I try, the more in focus it becomes. I slither out from underneath his arm and stumble to the bathroom, turning the faucet on full. I gulp down water, hoping to wash away the remnants of his saliva, which I swear I can feel on my teeth. After rinsing my mouth out a few dozen times, I return to the bedroom to find my clothes so I can sneak out, but my shirt seems to have disappeared. I decide to borrow one of Kevin's, or at least so I hope, which is draped over a chair. Knowing Kevin will wonder where I am, I rummage through my backpack and rip a page out of my script to write a note. Unsure of what to say, I leave it cryptic yet positive. Kevin, didn't have the heart to wake you, as I know you'll need your strength for tonight. I couldn't find my shirt and borrowed one of yours. I look forward to tonight. Mason. The words feel strange, but nothing better comes to mind, so I fold the paper and leave it by the bedside table, just inches away from Kevin's sleeping body. I take one last look at him, sprawled out across the entire bed, the single bed sheet draped stylishly about his godlike form just barely covers him. If I hadn't slept here, I would swear a designer came in during the night to style him this way, as the coverage is artfully placed to preserve his modesty. I dig my fingernails into my hand, hoping I can reprogram myself to associate pain with his visage instead of lust and longing. Eventually, I have the power to turn away and return home.